In my forthcoming book, The Happy End, All Welcome, there's a character who is the assistant director. He speaks to other characters in the book through a megaphone. And in some instance, he puts out this call. Call for feeling, manufacturers. Use color to shape the public's emotions. Add a little jingle and bingo. Three people sitting on a tandem bench. Come forth. Each applicant is assigned a color around which to improvise lyrics for jingles. Only found language displayed in the color assigned to each can be used. Applicants are given 2 hours to go searching for words in the city. The assistant director selects corresponding loops from the Buddha machine, a portable music player, as accompaniment. Blue. Service changes. For more information, please call Delta. Clean air, hybrid. Electric air, electric hybrid. Retail hybrid. Space available. For more information, please call dry cleaners. Mechanical voice available. It's free. Hybrid. Airstream. It's free. Let's celebrate. Integrated ambulance. Integrated police. Metro hybrid. Voice. It's free. Mechanical voice available. Let's celebrate better rates, new friendly coin operated commuter and service. Airstream service changes. Stream Air change services. Change Air stream services. Stream change air services. Change stream service air stream services. Air changes. Red. Private property. Do not lean between cars. Do not lean. Exit. 99 cent paradise. The next stop is outside of the subway is dangerous. Billiards and bar. It is a violation to ride or walk. Help us keep the subway clean and get over it. Ask the station agent for your litter-free ATM. Yeah, yeah. Hats, games, gags, and magic are subject to random search. Exit. Masters of masquerade. Get over it. Exit. Makeup, wigs, health food, 3-hour photo. Ask the station agent for respect. Ask the station agent for your loft for rent. 99 cent paradise. Emergency exit only. If you drop something, don't go ask the station agent for your safety. Emergency exit only. Yellow. Dolls, where family fun is no illusion. A new competition reality series. Where construction fraud is no illusion. Free. Wage or other labor violations. Free. Unsafe policies and conditions. Where employee misconduct is no illusion. Free. False disability and injury claims. Where contractor and vendor fraud is no illusion. Where theft of MTA property is no illusion. Too much debt, divorce, or family court. Inefficiencies and waste of money. Free. Watch and jewelry. Payment plans. Free consultation. Special offer. Call. Mail. Blue Big Wizard. Lottery. Clean up after your dog. Zing Zang Zoom. Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey. Where illusion is family fun. At the end of the performances, the assistant director hollers into a megaphone. Rate the performance. Did the previous works match the color they have been assigned? Did blue feel blue? Fill in the blank. Red made you feel blank. If yellow gave you anxiety, please contact the company's management. Another imperfect utterance. It's called Cease to Stutter, Sing Song. No, no, sino. No, no, sino, si. No, si, sino. No, si, sino, no. Si, no, si, no. Si, no, si, no, no. Si, si, no. Si, no, si. Si, no, no. Si, no. No, sí. Si no, no, no. Si no, no, sí. Si no, 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 sí. Si no, 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 no. No, no, no. No, no, sí. No, 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 sino, no, no. No, sí, no, sino, sino. Sino. Thank you.
Dear listeners, welcome to Symposium. Tonight, in the company of poet, scholar, and editor Monica de la Torre and her fabulous Buddha machine, we just heard some poems written and read by Monica de la Torre. And now we will proceed to our recorded conversation from a couple of weeks ago. This, I know, might be for some of you the wrong order of events. In which case, we recommend that you play our program in a loop. With that, you download it and try to listen to it in reverse. These are puzzling thoughts, even for myself. So let's just pretend this is the beginning of the program, and I haven't even said good evening yet.
is a Buddha machine?
A Buddha machine is a portable loop player. What is a portable loop player? As you know, mm-hmm. you can device yourself, you can come up with, you can compose loops, right, on a machine, on your computer, if you want. But if you just wanted to play loops and they're not recorded, you could buy yourself a Buddha machine where musicians, different musicians and DJs have composed these loops for other people to listen to and perhaps to induce trances. A trance-like state, if you're just hearing a loop, an endless loop, over and over and over again. But it also has an interface that allows you to control the pitch of the loop and to plug it into a sound system so that you can actually use it as an instrument. So it's DJs making their loops available for other people to use them as they please. So at a time, I was thinking a lot about synesthesia and the relationship between color and sound. And I had a loop machine, a Buddha loop machine, that I think it was the first version. I forget who the composers and DJs are, but there were two guys. I think the next generation was done by Genesis Breyer Peorage. So I attributed a specific color to each one of the loops and used it to as a background sound for these poems that I wrote that were the result of color walks.
So you have the sound files and you could show me some of those sounds.
Yes, files. I could actually just read the poems. I could generate myself these recordings for you. What I've done in the past is simply when I give readings of these poems, I'll have my loop machine with me and I'm actually playing it as an instrument while I'm reading a poem. You see? But I will just record myself with the loop machine playing in the background. And ideally, you'll be able to hear the relationship between a specific color and the loop that I'm playing. And this all relates to a number of things that I dealt with in my book that's about to come out. What is a poem? You could say that a poem is, to a degree, a feeling, a machine that manufactures feeling. Okay? A poem is a device that generates, if the poem succeeds, this poem generates a feeling in its listener. So it's basically an instrument or a device that allows you to manufacture feelings. Color also manufactures feeling, especially when color is used in the commercial world and in advertising, correct? So in this book, I deal with the premise is that the largest theater company in the world, which is the Nature Theater of Oklahoma, which is the company that appears in Kafka's Unfinished America, is having a job fair. And there's jobs for everyone. And as a poet, this is particularly relevant because poets are, by and large, unemployable. Poets...
Is that so?
A poet as a poet is largely unemployable. We wear all these different hats, but we use certain things that imply a certain honing of skills through poetry, but we actually subvert and go against them when we deploy them for other means. AKA, what I'm talking specifically about advertising, right? A good jingle has the same elements as poetry. It's just selling you something. This reminds me of a very wonderful and quotable definition of poetry by David Anton. David Anton said that a poem is an advertising that doesn't sell you anything. It's a commercial that doesn't sell you anything.
But that kind of conflicts with the current trend of advertising,
mm-hmm.
at least in some part of the world,
yes.
where the jingle or the punchline has to be good, period.
Right.
And that generates attention and generates agreement and amusement, and it's simply associated with a brand.
Right.
A good joke and the brand that makes you remember the brand, the job is done. And the language itself is not selling you anything. The placement of language is helping the brand.
Right.
And that seems to be the current trend.
Yes.
In advertising. So poetry seems to be, it just seems to have regained or recovered some territory in the old advertising industry.
Yes.
Which obviously should bring us to some sort of neo Frankfurt School kind of debate, right?
Yes.
About the culture industry and the role of advertisement,
of course.
And that old motto that I always remember, and that is one of my favorite of Adorno and Horkheimer, when they say that, for instance, film is intrinsically advertising.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because it is an advertising for the entire culture industry. It promotes the culture industry as such.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, I mean, not that this regain of territory not that it implies any kind of emancipation, but it actually has made advertising slightly smarter.
Absolutely. Yes, I mean, following on what you're saying, of course, advertising is always ahead, right? And advertising, like poetry, in a way, plays with subverting expectations, surprising the consumer. And so we're all used to a certain form of advertising, and then advertising needs to change the game in order to still captivate our attentions, because we're so bombarded by advertising that we become immune or desensitized to the mechanisms that they deploy in order to convince us of something. So they start becoming more open, more elliptical, more obscure, mysterious. Sometimes they don't even, I mean, also it's like they're so attuned to how our psychology works that if something is too obvious, like nothing is more of a letdown, or nothing puts you, it's like it puts you off so much as desperation. So if something too desperately tries to appeal to you, you lose interest. It's all playing with the laws of desire in a way. So the most sophisticated advertising doesn't even let you know that they're actually trying to sell you something, right? But anyway, that might go in a direction that is too far afield from what I wanted to say about these color
walks. But I would tell you, going back to your definition of the poem, or your reference to definitions of the poem as a certain type of device, I would tell you that some critics, and I don't say that I agree or disagree, but I think it's a very reasonable claim, would tell you that the poem as a particular device that doesn't sell you anything is a very, very new kind of object. That if you think about poetry traditionally, what you realize is that in those eras where there was no such thing as an apparatus of advertising, the poem would incorporate elements of propaganda, ideological elements, ingredients that had to do with feeling, but feelings that were not necessarily authentic. And all
completely.
And all that was in the poem. And we've come to a segregation of the different functions that were activated by the object poem. And now we have like the purely poetic function, which is a modernist invention. And you would have the purely propagandistic function that would happen in propaganda, which itself is informed by the language of advertising.
Yeah.
And in advertising commercial.
Right.
You know, material. And all that stuff composes a larger picture of the contemporary poetic.
Well, somewhere you mentioned, like, you a poem can, especially in the past, no? I'm thinking of, like, in the Spanish Golden Age, for instance. No, even before, like, troubadour poetry, etc. Authenticity is not the point.
right? That's a very romantic idea. The idea of the poet as the only person in society that has authentic feelings is a complete fabrication of the romantic period. But before that, when you think of the troubadour tradition, etc., it's all about this artifice. Through artifice, you will create the illusion of the lover who is even creating the addressee, right? The addressee does not exist. The addressee of the person to whom the beloved to whom the poem is addressed and who inspires the poem is herself an illusion that the poem creates. And so I'm thinking, but then again, that is not to say that there is such a clear-cut relationship between artifice and authenticity, because I always like to think about Pessoa and that wonderful poem that he has where he says, the poet is a faker who fakes the feelings he truly has. Right? Isn't that? I think that beautifully encapsulates that relationship between the artifice of writing a poem through your manipulation of memories, emotions, associations that you truly have. But once they're on paper, whether they're authentic or not is completely irrelevant. I find that question so boring. There is no question that bores me more than whether a poem is authentic or not. But anyway.
I do think that yes. There is a... I mean, when you were talking about like the unemployable poet,
mm-hmm.
The problem might be in the bourgeois mindset that decides not to pay the poet, number one, for his function, normally
mm-hmm.
his,
mm-hmm.
if we're talking about the romantics. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, the problem is itself about what the poet produces or fabricates and its actual value.
Right.
So, on the one hand, you have the fact that he actually works.
Yes.
The romantic poet, you know, it's so like a cliche romantic poet, is busy feeling.
Right.
He's busy with his feelings.
Oh, I love that.
Very
yeah.
busy with his feelings.
I'm so busy feeling.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm feeling so intensely, and that's my job.
Yeah.
And that would be a good caricature of the romantic poet. And on the other hand, the fact that the bourgeois society seems to not care about those feelings, which is also why the romantic poet has this rebellious allure.
Right.
But meanwhile, the romantic poet has the feeling that he, and I'm speaking about a cliché that is a masculine cliché mostly, I think,
mm-hmm.
he is not only the shepherd of feelings, but
mm-hmm.
he's also the protector of true feelings.
Of course.
In a way, the truth of feelings will be endangered without the poet,
right.
And the poet exists because of that endangerment
right.
of real feelings.
Right.
So there is a job there, and
mm-hmm.
there is a function,
mm-hmm.
even though, one, the function might be invented by
yes.
the actual agent of the function, and two, the function itself is considered non-functional by society, which the poet
mm-hmm.
contradicts.
Exactly, exactly.
And, you know, actually, I think historically it has been demonstrated that
yeah.
yes, the poetry needed to remain. The poetry was,
of course,
in you know, in the happiest cases, necessary.
Yes.
For a culture, for any culture.
Yes, I keep thinking about you were quoting Adorno before, and I keep thinking of his vision of the poet. The poet is a function of the social order that, through the division of labor, relegates the preservation of the feelings of alienation from the industrial order to the poet, right? So but so you tell that to lyric poets today, and they are horrified. They really believe that their job is to defy the contemporary social order. And if you look at it through Adorno's lens, that is precisely what the social order demands that they perform. That role of catharsis, right? And it really, ultimately, I don't think it matters either way, whatever. Do your thing, you know? We're all, like, we can't really escape. What does matter to me at least, is a certain critical relationship to the language that you use.
But here's the interesting twist.
Mm-hmm.
Catharsis is an effect.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a product.
Claro.
It's the effect of the good product.
Yes.
Which doesn't justify the existence of the product if it doesn't produce it. Now, we live in a time where highly specialized tasks like writing poetry might be only fully available in the richness of their effects to those who deeply study them, which might be only those who actually produce it. And therefore we enter that realm of like poets writing for poets and poets only being read by poets and claiming that their whatever their work is necessary to society, and it's society's problem that this material doesn't reach the core or the, you know, the hurting heart of the social whatever intelligence, the collective intelligence, the collective soul. Therefore we are confronted with the idea that the poet is sort of like self-vindicating and at the same time claiming a parcel of productivity that is not necessarily recognized by the outside.
Right.
And the poet is accusing the outside of not recognizing that, and being a poet becomes a circular conversation. And it becomes a circular function, a circular job. It's sort of like, you know, you know, it's like digging a hole and covering another hole with the sand that you take out, and then you do the reverse. And I don't know what kind of circular, you know, it's I mean, I don't want to say endogamic. I want to say it's like a closed circuit. It's like a locked groove.
Absolutely. But I think this is really, this is deeply interesting to me, because I think that exchange, no? That, like, if the poet plays a role in society, then we are talking about the fact that there exists an exchange between the reader and the poet, right? And so this good that you're producing is circulating in society. But I do think that we exist in a moment, I completely agree with what you're saying, we exist in a moment in which that exchange is merely symbolic. And the actual poetry now, to me, is an empty signifier. You need, society needs poetry to exist as a this empty category.
And now, a special message from our faceless listenership.
Society needs poetry to exist as this empty category. I think it's empty on two counts. One, yes, Duchamp, absolutely, in the sense that, I don't know if we're understanding it in the same way, you're probably more specific than I, but the way I understand it is that poetry, the poem, an instance of poetry embodied in a poem, is so concrete that it defies poetry as a category. So the poem itself doesn't, the poem itself as an act of, as a linguistic event, produces an exchange between the reader and itself that is largely unquantifiable, ephemeral to an extreme, and completely undecidable or unpinnable. You cannot pin that down. Right? Except for maybe in a classroom there is one right way to read a poem and you can assess whether the readers are actually getting the poem or they're not getting it, but that is not the way a poem exists in society. And I think In other words, what I'm trying to say is that half of the job of the poem is performed by the actual reader. And in that sense, the poem itself is empty enough that it allows it to receive all kinds of interpretations. Like Duchamp would say, that the audience completes the art, no? In that particular way. I also think that the author function in a poem is a result, again, of what the world around the poem creates. That context created collectively is not determined by the poem itself, and in that sense, also poetry is empty. But I also mean I'm thinking, for instance, of Bolaño's The Savage Detectives. Poetry as a category has a lot of cultural capital. So poetry has cultural capital as a category, but the poem itself is irrelevant when it comes to that category. So if you read The Savage Detectives, the fact that the crew of characters, that the cast of characters are poets, marginal poets, adds to the mystique and the complexity of the group of people depicted in the novel. But poetry itself only appears as this empty category. Poetry itself does not appear in that book.
That is the second mm-hmm. part of the question I mm-hmm. wanted to ask you. On the one hand, you have the empty signifier of the poem as, let's say, a projection screen mm-hmm. that, you know, the reader is going to activate and so on.
Yeah.
But on the other, when you say poetry is an empty signifier or the poem mm-hmm. Is an empty object, what I also hear is that the function of poets and the function of the exercise mm-hmm. of poetry might be simply the preservation of poetry.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that there is a lack of arguments
mm-hmm.
for the full disappearance
mm-hmm.
of poetry and mm-hmm. all these old functions.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lack of arguments about what poetry is or should be today.
Right.
And there is certainly no argument that can determine the nature of poetry in the
mm-hmm.
future.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the exercise must be pursued and continued ad infinitum
mm-hmm.
because of this empty
mm-hmm.
Essence.
Yes. Now, yes, and I think we can push that further. Why do we need to preserve poetry as a category? I think that it's the only thing that reminds us of the infinite malleability and richness of language. Right? I mean, poetry is the thing that reminds us that language as a living entity has infinite forms and can take myriads of more forms.
Yes, but this is like when Ernest Gombrich
mm-hmm.
would say something like this about sculpture and
mm-hmm.
say like, well, sculpture allows you to observe all the varieties of textures, allows you to look
mm-hmm.
and to see material,
mm-hmm.
but how is it that we see material qualities in sculpture and we don't have the emotion we have when we look at a sculpture, at an abstract sculpture,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
when we look at a bundle of rags or like
right.
a piece of paper that has been like a
mm-hmm.
crumbled piece of paper
mm-hmm.
or, you know,
mm-hmm.
things that are themselves very rich,
right.
but they have no artistic value and they don't provoke these emotions
yeah.
that you have when you look at a sculpture, however abstract and
mm-hmm.
and completely empty of reference or literalistic, and that object seems to be teaching you something about reality.
But, yes, poetry sensitizes you to linguistic events. And I do think that we all respond to language constantly. We all, because everybody, even though language is one thing, right? You speak Spanish or you speak Euskera or you speak French or you speak whatever it is that it is, and everybody knows what the codes of that language are, every instance of the deployment of a language is unique. How can it, we all speak differently? And I think when you read poetry, you become much more aware of it. But you don't even need poetry to know that, because we all, as listeners, respond to a person's intonation. We respond to humor, ironic uses of certain phrases, mimicry. Right? People mocking other people's speech. It's astonishing. To me, it's the most beautiful thing in the world.
The funny thing is that when I was thinking about our program, the sort of like instinctive title, which is itself a cliche, and not only a cliche, it is a bad trope of particularly Latin American poetry, and is this expression of el oficio de poeta.
Ugh.
And I was gonna pierce that, because we've been talking about el oficio de poeta, the poet's job,
exactly,
or the poet's trade.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Oficio is a word that doesn't really correspond to anything in particular. In English, it's a poet's craft, and it's a trade at the same time.
Right. Or it's the poet's labor and craft.
It's labor and craft, but it's also the trade.
Yeah. It's also the trade. Absolutely.
This is my trade.
Yes. So in this book, that's exactly what I'm playing with. At this job fair, there is a position for everyone, in theory. It sort of relates to Martin Kippenberger's installation, The Happy End of Kafka's America. That was what prompted the book. But what I do in it is every poem is either a job interview of sorts, very loosely understood. It could be a dialogue where one person is applying for a job. Again, it's very metaphorical, because I would hate for people to think that they're actually going to find transcriptions of job interviews in this book. It's very open. But so there could be that. There could be tests in which you're actually deploying certain skills as a poet to test your ability to access the world of poetry or not. But the jobs that are being utilized in the context of the book are all around the notion too of performativity and performance. And since I am a poet, mainly what occurs is a performance of poetry. So for instance, in this piece that I was telling you about at first, where I used the Buddha machines, there is a production manager who puts out a call for feeling manufacturers, and three people, so it's also a book that's very novelistic in a sense, because there are characters. So three applicants decide to perform this test to see if they're adequate feeling manufacturers. They go out on the street and embark on color walks. So what they do is that they take down language that's been, it's public language, public out on the street, that is printed on specific colors. So if you went on a color walk and you only could use yellow, you would discover really interesting things about why on a public sign the person decided to make yellow the color for that thing that they're telling you. So it also deals with interpolation. It's very interesting experiment that I actually didn't come up with myself. It's something that Brian Geisen, and William Burroughs used to do. They would go out on color walks. So the colors are yellow, green, blue, and orange, and these three people take found language only in that color, and then they write these jingles. And when performing these works, I use the Buddha loops, because the loops, each one, I think, corresponds to a certain color. So at the end of the piece, then you as a reader are asked whether you saw a connection between the color and the jingle, and how effectively you think these poems generated a feeling in you. And then this other one is called Monolingualism of the Other, and it's an erasure of the first chapter of Derrida's Monolingualism of the Other. And so what I did, it's a poem in French, Spanish, and English, and I took monosyllables in Spanish, monosyllables in French, and monosyllables in English, in that first chapter.
It's the monosyllabism of the other instead of the monolingualism.
Yes, exactly. So this is what it looks like. And I then superimpose them. So the poem looks like this. Oops. And so you have these... Okay, so what dominates? English. Because English has all these words that are monosyllables, and they're actually pretty complex concepts. You don't have that in Spanish, and you don't have that in French. And when I read this poem out loud, no, I don't read it out loud because it's impossible to do it three times simultaneously in three languages. So I've recorded the Spanish, the English, and the French, and then I mix the three tracks, and the sound is really cool.
And you have that?
And I have that.
Oh, great. Yeah. Perfect.
Yeah, but I've never been able to do anything with this one except for just show it on the page. And I think that's it for this book in terms of plays with... There's another one. This one's really... I like it, and it's very... very difficult to read out loud. I've done it two times.
Holy Jesus.
I've done it two times, and it's torture for me and possibly for the readers as well. And this is a piece...
For the listeners?
For the listeners. Thank you very much for the correction. It's the last sentence of this poem is, if war does not sing, it makes noise. And what I was attempting to do is to remove all vowels from words, because vowels are what convey, what bestow lyricism to language. If you take the vowels out, the language ceases to be lyrical. And this was a poem written during the Bush years. And the entire book is very political. It has that undertone. It's very critical. And it deals with precisely war. And the negotiation interiorly of private concerns that appear trivial in light of what's happening publicly. And so that negotiation is what this poem deals with. So I can just like... No, I'm not even going to do it.
No, I want you to do it alone, home, with the device, so that you can really find the tune. And you know, like, you know that we've talked about this several times. I have a particular dislike. I do like the act of reading, but I don't like the... theatrical act of the reading.
Yes.
You know what I mean? Like, I like the act of reading, but not the theatrical act of the reading.
Yeah.
And I think the reading is much more authentic, if I can use that word, or at least interesting when you are...
When I am...
When you are alone with the microphone, and you have to accept the embarrassment of speaking with yourself as an only listener.
Yes. But it's actually less embarrassing than pretending like you're doing that in front of an audience. Because with a lot of poetry that's confessional, there's no addressee. Like, it's not an instance of public speaking.
No one should read that stuff ever to anybody.
This Kehu word el the French what is called and as a gin of for we say lo now for they that one would you tell you in good have one. It. No. Not mine. Ma. Or still. Am. La. My. Or. Soil. I call. In me. We. In. Dict. Which. Draw. Ye. Me. So. Breath. But. Al. By. It's. Fu. That. Does. Mean. Say. Par. Some. Or. This. Truth. Call. Ubo. All things. For. Speak. Ling. Bin. Mal. Bound. Vows, ni, yet so, will, thus, rien, long, sin, speech, no, life, de, death, see, bien, tell, don't was, bien, once, source, son, place, hopes, that, since, sort, runs, that right, be, them, to, wrong shores, north, line, act, coast, can love, pray, die,
Pain, just plain at edge. Sharp, sword, back, wish to, words, take, does, hold, rate, it's, does, with your, makes no sense. Has, no, how, could, theirs, claims, sort, drags, heal, I, when, would, worst case, which on, act, did, say, soy, my, me, ruins, indeed, loin, proof, votre cause, del, give, I, stop, yo, so, why last? Share this word, more or less, comme les mots, qu'ils ont mal caught up, fat, so, now, claim, it, share, same, trick, please, knots, they make, that are found, lay, push more, that, falls far, lying, calls, stir, when, cause, card, come off, so, well, draw first, seen, old, comme, rate, talvez, short, that, out, let mine, type, that, phrase, want, here, this means, dare, nos creen, think, then, what, pues creen, grand, sus, nos, then, quien, fu, ser. Thank you.